This is Monocle's House View coming up today.
The best advice for Africa is to prepare for the worst and prepare today. It's actually better, if these numbers are really true, to cut it from the bud.
A warning from the WHO to Africa over COVID-19. My guests Yasmin Abdul-Majid and Michael Binion will discuss that and the day's other news, including as South Africa fences off its border with Zimbabwe, are we about to witness a further uptick in nativism, or might a global problem prompt greater global solidarity? And what do we make of the astonishing catalysing of online community building, and how can it be sustained? Plus, I'll reflect on what we have learn from one of the weirdest weeks of the 21st century. I'm Andrew Muller. Monocle's House View starts now. Welcome to the show. I'm joined by Michael Binion, foreign affairs expert at The Times, and Yasmin Abdul-Majid, the writer and broadcaster. The COVID-19 outbreak, as we understand all too well by now, is a global problem. Some parts of the world, however, have learned this earlier than others, and in other parts, the worst remains yet to come. As is the case with all disasters, this will be rougher on countries which lack resources, a disproportionate quantity of which are in Africa. Relatively few cases have as yet been confirmed across the continent, but there seems little chance that such numbers as we know will not rise. Nigeria, with a population of 162 million, has so far reported 8 cases. Yasmin, first of all, I don't want to indulge in ghoulish catastrophizing, but how prepared are African countries for what might be about to hit them?
Well, it's a tough question, and I think different countries on the continent are going to have different levels of readiness. So my family, being in Sudan, is, you know, Sudan is not a country that is known for its health infrastructure. And so I think it's going to have a lot more difficulty simply because the resources aren't there and people are already struggling with all sorts of other issues. You know, these are not nations, sadly, that are sort of like stable and healthy, holy. I think there are the challenge, of course, is also, as mentioned, the testing numbers are significantly lower, and getting out to test people and so on is going to be a challenge in of itself. And so, in a way, a lot of these countries are dealing or are trying to sort the situation out, but sort of blindly, because they don't know how many people they need to prepare for. A lot of the infections initially were coming in, as in many other cases, from travelers who've come back to whatever country it might be. But I think generally these countries are not as prepared from an infrastructure point of view. However, what I would say is that a lot of folks anecdotally are prepared for outbreaks, right? Like, people are accustomed to deal. You've got Ebola in West Africa that happened a few years ago. And so you do have an institutional level of understanding of how to isolate and so on. The question then becomes, in the same way that we've looked here in Britain, where you've got an NHS or a health service that is overwhelmed because of this exponential rise in numbers, what happens when, okay, yes, we have the institutional knowledge perhaps to deal with this, but we simply just don't have the number of beds?
Michael, as Yasmin suggests, and it is an extremely thickly disguised blessing, but Africa does have frequent and recent experience of dealing with pandemics, most obviously, famously, the relatively recent Ebola outbreak. Is there any hope at all that that may provide it with certain advantages, certain foreknowledge?
I think there is, yes. And I think that certainly in the West Africa, the experience of how to break age-old habits of everyone crowding around for funerals and things like that was successful in the end, although it met some resistance. And I think those lessons have been wider spread. And Africa is, well, it, you know, Africans are aware of what's happening elsewhere on their own continent. And those lessons are not just confined to West Africa. I think that's a very important thing. There are regional centers of health excellence in the big cities in Africa, particularly Kenya, South Africa, other countries where there's some fairly well-developed systems. And I think the difficulty is, of course, to break habits of people joining in things together and to get people to isolate. Now, that's quite difficult in an African context. Real isolation is very difficult.
Yasmin, as we were discussing at the top, and as you quite correctly observed, you know, different countries in Africa will respond to this in different ways. And I'm very much trying to avoid the whole Africa is a country trope here. But does it strike you that some might be better prepared for this than others?
I think so. And it depends on a number of different things. It depends on the sort of quote unquote level of health infrastructure development. It also depends on how, you know, the levels of trust and communication within the population. So is this a country where people have are sending tons of misinformation throughout WhatsApp groups and nobody's going to listen to anything that comes from an authority? Or is it a place that, you know, people have some understanding of, you know, the authorities are, at least in this case, probably to be listened to and so on? I think these sorts of things. The challenge, of course, is one of the challenges is the level of trust in authorities around this. And we've even, again, seen that in Western countries where people are not listening to leaders or are not listening to advice that's coming in, partly because the advice might not be clear, but also partly because there's this sort of people aren't used to these sorts of changes, right? And so when you have to break those habits, as rightly pointed out, you have to have the same messaging over and over and over until, you know, there's a critical mass of people doing that. And so I think certainly, again, anecdotally in Sudan, I know that there's been a real shift. Like once the government decided to shut down the airport, just sort of with immediate effect, leaving some people stuck in, you know, in transit all over the world. But what it did mean is that it immediately put this sort of like shot through the system and people sort of started changing their behaviors. I think that is one element of it. But again, I mean, obviously South Africa is probably going to be better prepared than, you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, because of what already is going on in various places. And I just think hopefully if there is infrastructure for these sort of centers of health excellence to also communicate, that will allay some of the difficulties, hopefully.
Michael Binion and Yasmin Abdul-Majid, will have more from you both in just a moment. But first, here is Monocle's Marcus Hippie with some of the other stories we're following today.
Thanks, Andrew. California has told residents to stay at home in a bid to stop the spread of coronavirus. Governor Gavin Newsom added that Californians should only leave their homes when necessary during the pandemic. He estimates half of the 40 million people in his state will contract COVID-19 in the next 2 months. Argentina has become the first Latin American country to impose a nationwide lockdown. Leaders are also announcing an obligatory quarantine to curb the spread of coronavirus. Argentina has already closed its borders for a total of 15 days and suspended flights from other countries. Leading British scientists say that restricting social contact could be needed for at least half of the year in order to stop hospital units becoming overwhelmed. The UK government's scientific advisers say the measures could include isolating individuals and households. And finally, the Sanriku railway line in northeastern Japan has resumed operations 5 months after it was badly damaged by a powerful typhoon. The line has been a symbol of reconstruction since the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, which inflicted serious damage to its facilities. Those are the headlines. Now back to Andrew.
Thanks, Marcus. This is Monocle's House View. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are Yasmin Abdul-Majid and Michael Binion. Let's move along slightly and look at one African border, the one separating South Africa from Zimbabwe. South Africa has announced that it will build 40 kilometres of fence along it to keep out migrants and, so South Africa insists, COVID-19. Although no cases have been confirmed in Zimbabwe, it would seem unlikely that that one country had escaped. It feels like a signal of something. Is a moment at which closing borders has suddenly become not merely justifiable, but perhaps necessary, going to be seized by unscrupulous nativists? Michael, let's look at this border specifically. We know by now that coronavirus is no respecter of international frontiers. Is this largely a cosmetic exercise?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it's something to show that the government is taking steps to protect its own people and that it's not going to allow hundreds or thousands of others to flee into what may be a better healthcare system. Not that they're likely to do so, especially if they're coming from a country which doesn't have COVID-19 yet, going to a country which already does. but it is a gesture, and it's a populist gesture. And as such, I'm afraid it's rather damaging. It's inevitable we're going to have gestures of this kind. It's a waste of time. I mean, you know, if the border fence is only going to be 40 kilometres or whatever, people can just go a bit further on and come around the other end of it. I mean, it's frankly pointless. But it may have an underlying message that trust ourselves and keep foreigners out, which I think is a nationalistic message we're going to see increasingly across the continent.
Yasmin, I think it's something worryingly I suspect we're going to see everywhere, because one of the great rallying cries of xenophobes and nativists in recent years especially has been, we can't take any more people in, we can't help the ones we have. If that becomes literally true, does that empower them all the more?
Yeah, it's been fascinating to sort of see the closing down of borders the world over, and this, which initially, of course, is about actual requirements to sort of stop the virus coming in from travelers. But I do worry about measures that, you know, there's a famous quote, which is sort of like, nothing's more permanent than a temporary government program, right? Or a temporary government measure. And I think part of the challenge is once you've got a crisis that allows for these sorts of quite drastic things, to drastic policy changes, will there be a huge fight to change the rhetoric once things are sort of settled down, or once, you know, we've got a vaccine or whatever the end point of this pandemic is? Even again here in the UK, as a comparison point, there was Boris Johnson, I put out new policies around, you know, the sort of police having extra powers to detain folks and so on. And of course, if you've got a country that's locked down in order to protect its people, fine. But okay, at what point are these policies and decisions going to be abused? And how do we make sure we don't allow things to pass that haven't been scrutinized appropriately? I do think it's a really fine line between protecting people in times of crisis and starting to sneak in sort of more xenophobic or nativist rhetoric. I mean, even Donald Trump still calls this the Chinese virus, right? It's in, because then you can sort of make it this thing that we can fight by locking down our borders. The fact that even a virus is being personified as, an outsider or an other should be something that we are quite concerned about.
Michael, do you think it's possible at all for us to indulge the hope that this crisis may lead to a certain widespread finding out of populist yahoos who have in recent years been insisting that, you know, there are simple solutions to great problems and all we need to do is do these very simple things and we can fix everything if only you would listen to me?
Well, I think it does depend on whether the science works, whether people feel that those scientists who have been making a lot of the running, particularly in Western countries, and are clearly guiding policy, whether they have actually come up with the best solution possible. And if that's the case, then there will be massive new respect for certainly scientific experts, medical experts. There will be a new emphasis on the importance of general health. There will be probably a better, kinder society, certainly for a while. But I also think it's important that the fakes and the fake news peddlers are shown up pretty quickly. And that is coming out. There's been a lot of denunciation of some of the more ridiculous things that are circulating. The trouble is they have plenty of time still to do it, and they can do a lot of damage and cause a lot of anxiety. And fighting anxiety is half the battle in trying to keep the country, all countries, sane and healthy.
Yasmin, I'll put an is it too much to hope question to you as well, which is that you might like to think maybe that an actual global problem, and short of actual invasion by Martians, it's hard to imagine what more global a problem we could have in the short term anyway. Is there any hope, do you think, that it might actually reduce xenophobia?
Yeah, there's nothing like a common enemy to unite people, right? And typically that common enemy has been some sort of other. But if the common enemy is a virus, is something that, you know, is indiscriminate in the damage that it inflicts, you know, perhaps there is a hope. And it's been something that I have personally been yo-yoing about. It's sort of, will this usher in an era of, you know, people working from home and smiling at their neighbors and helping each other out? I think partly it also depends how long it goes for, right? If this is a couple of weeks, perhaps it might not break behaviors. But if we're in this situation for a few months, for a lot longer, and we end up in a situation where we cannot, like, we cannot pretend that the world is the same as it was in 2019, then I think it's unprecedented. And, you know, the comparison has been the plague or the Spanish influenza, and there have been all sorts of comparisons made to the period after these huge moments and what changed in society. And certainly I think there is huge potential in something as global as this to change politics, certainly in the immediate future. So we'll wait and see.
Well, that does tee up the last subject for today's news panel quite nicely, because as crises invariably do, this one has unleashed a kind of mad energy, and much of it, so far at least, pretty positive, generous and enterprising. This has been occurring largely online, which is understandable, as we're all going to be spending a lot more time there. Yasmin, I'll ask you first, as this panel's representative of the younger online generations, what has leapt out at you so far?
I have never had so many Zoom calls in my life.
See, I'm not even sure I know what a Zoom call is.
It's so whether it's FaceTime or, you know, any other type of video calling, I have actually chatted with friends, and obviously I grew up in Australia, so a huge bunch of my friends are in Australia and are in other time zones around the world. I have not chatted, I've sort of chatted more with my friends around the world in the last week than I have maybe in the last 3 years, which I don't know is an indictment of my personality and my ability to keep in touch with people or the current status quo. But certainly I think because everybody's online, everyone's just sitting at home on the internet. Well, a large portion, whoever can, I think, is sitting at home on the internet. You've all of a sudden got people with a whole bunch of time on their hands, a whole bunch of plans that have been cancelled, and people figuring out what to do. And I think there's certainly also this, as you say, the strange energy that's been unleashed. Everyone wants to kind of say something or do something or be contributing in some sort of way because we are social creatures. I'm really curious as to how long it'll last, but I do think, you know, there'll be really interesting new patterns develop.
And Michael, as this panel's representative of what I'm going to describe as a more distinguished generation,
the dinosaur generation.
Have you noticed anything of the sort yourself?
Yes, well, I've actually got the blooming virus myself right now.
Oh,
I'm pretty well coming out of it. It's the last, more or less the last day, and I'm very, very lucky that I had a really mild dose. I didn't have, you know, raging temperature or anything.
I mean, Michael, to use a journalistic term, way to bury the lead there.
Yeah, well, I thought I'd better come up front. But so wipe down your loudspeaker when you've listened to this broadcast and make sure. But, I mean, I have been heartened by, first of all, lots of neighbours coming along and you know, no shortage of we'll bring food or whatever you want. Lots of people. The other thing is technology. I'm pretty poor at that, but at least, you know, you can talk to children and grandchildren and whatever. We're going to have to rely on ourselves being. Luckily, I have outdoor space and things to go out and, you know, take fresh air and all that. So, but psychologically, it's very important. Support of others. Psychologically, it's important not to overdose with the tough news. I mean, you have to limit how much you follow in every detail. And the thing is, if you're interested in music or something, switch to that area. That's a completely different world. You'll find it really, really calming and relaxing, takes it out of you, takes you away from things. So there are lots of things I do find as a sort of positive spirit, neighborhood communities that have helped a lot. And I feel, you know, I'm really lucky.
Yasmin, have you thought personally about what you might be able to contribute in that kind of respect in terms, you know, you are somebody with a large online platform. And as I've been discovering in the last 24 hours, during which, for reasons I will not go into, I've mostly been trying to explain Australian rules football to dozens of curious Spaniards, which is not, I'm not sure that's how I imagined I would spend my time during a pandemic, but such is the world we live in. What are you planning to do, Yasmin, with, you know, your audience and your access to it?
Yeah, it's, again, something I've been spending quite a bit of time thinking about. I mean, yesterday I had a live Instagram session with a friend of mine who's a chef. She was on MasterChef in Australia, and we went through my pantry, and she gave me advice on what things I could make in a pandemic with all the things that I have in my kitchen, which was slightly embarrassing for me because it really showed up how little I knew about cooking. But certainly, you know, there's also... I mean, I have been thinking about what to offer, and some of it has been around, all right, I'm going to open up and do mentoring sessions, like half an hour mentoring sessions around careers and sort of things for younger people who are on my platform. I'm also, my last book was a young adult fiction novel, so I'm contemplating, I think next week I'll be sort of doing live readings on my Facebook and Instagram of, you know, me reading the book out loud. And, you know, I think I'm not the only person doing this. I've got friends who've sort of done live poetry and live music and so on. And it's been even live coffee making. So like barista friends, obviously, you know, the hospitality industry has been completely wiped out. They're now doing sort of like how to make a perfect coffee at home, sort of live streaming and so on. I think it is what will be, again, interesting is, how long can we maintain this? I'm really curious about it. And I'm also curious about how do I not overwhelm people? Because everyone right now wants to do, you know, so I'm also part of the mutual aid groups in my local area. And we have significantly more people that want to help than need help. And so whether that will change over time or whether it's actually just a really great thing and now we're going to make connections in the local community that weren't there before, I'm really curious. Yeah, it's certainly a really interesting time to be alive.
Michael, just finally and just briefly, speaking as somebody who has had this and by the sound of it, getting through it, which is outstanding news, is there anything you can pass on to people who find themselves getting ill? Because obviously it's not going to be just the getting ill, it's going to be the worry about being ill.
It is the panic. I mean, that actually makes it much worse. It's the sort of thinking of all the awful possibilities. I mean, it's just to try to train yourself to think positive, keep positive, focus on the things that relax your mind. I mean, it could be anything. I mean, if you feel up to it and can do crosswords or something like that, most people can't, you know, people say that's a waste of time, or watch something. Don't, I mean, it sounds silly, but from a journalist, but don't overdose on the bad news, because that will just make you anxious, and that is not good. Think about, you know, what's come through and what you're going to do. You do value your own family relationships enormously and much more than you thought you would. You know, people you've been with for all your life, you suddenly see them afresh and think, wow, how important for me. And that is a very positive message.
Yasmin Abdul-Majeed and Michael Binion, thank you, Michael. Get well soon. In a moment, we'll be hearing a little bit more about what exactly we have learned this week. It's hard to know where to start. You're listening to Monocle's House View. Stay tuned. This is Monocle's House View. I'm Andrew Muller. Finally today, time for my weekly reflection on what we learned. We learned this week at least the beginnings of how the COVID-19 outbreak is going to disrupt our lives. Around the world, skies have emptied of planes, roads of cars, streets of people, schools of students, workplaces of workers. French President Emmanuel Macron went so far in an address to a nation which has living memory of occupation by a malign invader, and therefore does not chuck this rhetoric around lightly, as to say that his country was now at war.
Et une fois encore, j'en appelle à votre sens des responsabilités et de la solidarité. Dans ce contexte, après avoir consulté le président du Sénat, le président de l'Assemblée nationale,
we learned something of how rough this is going to be economically. All at once, industries in which millions of people make their livings have slowed down or halted. Here is the film critic Karen Krasanovich on Tuesday's briefing.
The film industry is generally like a circus. I mean, once you get sucked into it, you kind of don't come back out. But yes, of course, some people will find other ways of making a living. I know people have gone off and moved and gone to become artists or anything like that. But these people they're technical creatives, and that's sometimes quite a difficult fit. So I know that there are some people that are driving forklifts right now to try and sort of make ends meet.
So we learned that if you're more fortunate than most, now is an outstandingly good time to spend money on that local business you treasure or subscribe to that media outlet which you'll be relying on to keep you abreast of whatever lies ahead. But we learned and will hopefully learn to better appreciate that any virus which likes its chances will have to contend with some of the world's cleverer people. One of them, Cambridge University virologist Dr. Chris Smith, talked on Thursday's Globalist and Briefing about the race for a vaccine.
Well, the way in which this is approached is, first of all, you've got to understand, well, what does a vaccine do? A vaccine educates the body's immune system so it can recognise something, and that way it produces all of the things the immune system would produce during a natural infection, but they're pre-made and ready to go before you encounter the thing for real, so that when you do encounter the thing for real, there isn't this catch-up by the immune system while the disease runs amok.
We also learned that one of the many things which may end up being briskly rethought is Brexit, which you might recall being all the rage just a few weeks back. The UK has until June to seek an extension to its present transition period. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hitherto suggested that nothing could be less thinkable. This week, however...
And you had another question. What was it about? There's another subject. What was it? It's a subject that's been banished. It's been done. It's not a subject that's being regularly discussed, I can tell you, in Downing Street at the moment. And we're getting on with, you know, there's legislation in place that I have no intention of changing.
The phrase, no intention, is key, one of the most recognisable get-out clauses in politics. There was a time when Boris Johnson would say much the same about the prospect of seeking to lead his country.
I've got as much chance of being leader as that beagle has of finding Elvis Presley on Mars.
Well, they said you was high class, but that was just a lie.
Actually, we learned that lots of things, really almost everything, has been postponed for the foreseeable, but the inevitable cancellation of the Eurovision Song Contest felt, in the circumstances, an especially bitter blow. This is obviously nothing to do with the quality of the music usually furnished by the Pan-Continental Warbling Tournament, because there usually is no quality. But, like few other institutions, Eurovision seems to represent what we're going to have to learn to live without for a while. Something silly and joyous and harmless, and as much fun, indeed some of us would argue more so, to deride as appreciate. Here is Monocle's indefatigable, unbowed and resolute Eurovision desk chief, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, on Thursday's briefing.
First time in 64 years that the event's not happening. It's remarkable. I believe the event will remain in Rotterdam next year. Mm-hmm. They decided to cancel, so because there was a talk that it would be an event without an audience, I don't think they wanted that. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if the acts from this year will go ahead for next year. There's still lots to be discussed.
But we learned that we will not be left to struggle along entirely without fatuously sentimental lyrics sung badly to nursery rhyme melodies. For we also learned that there is no historical moment so grave that a bunch of sanctimonious poseurs from the dressing up and pretending trade won't assume that what we really want now is a mawkish rendition of the worst song ever written.
If you try,
no hell below us,
above us only sky.
Imagine all the
And no, I won't be naming any of them. It's what they want.
For today, yeah.
And we, at least, we fretful sports fans wondering how we're going to fill days or weeks of confinement, learned that at least one sport is willing to call play on. As almost everything else went into hibernation, the Australian Football League, the top flight competition of Australian rules football, started its 2020 season as scheduled.
Okay, let's have a little listen to this, because this is something we've never seen before in football, and experience as much of the atmosphere here as we can. The Blues about to run out onto the hallowed turf, the MCG. As we mentioned, there's no banner, there's no cheer squad, and there are no fans.
The games have been shortened and the stadiums locked. But it's there, for the moment at least, and there will never be a better time to get into what one Australian Prime Minister, Sir Robert Menzies, correctly described as the greatest winter game devised by mortal man. This segment takes seriously its role as an impartial servant of the truth and would never so much as dream as influencing any listener vis-a-vis which Australian rules team they should support. And now, some music.
We are Geelong, the greatest team of all. We are Geelong, we're always on the ball. We play the game as it should be played.
That's all for today's show. Monocle's House View is produced by Augustin Macellari. Our studio managers were Steph Chungu and Christy Evans. Coming up at 20:00, a brand new edition of The Menu. Monocle's House View returns at 9 a.m. tomorrow, London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.